Elzomine. As you know, I'm an avid hiker. The stories that are shared amongst hikers are similar to fishermen in that there's often talk about the one that got away, that is, the peak you couldn't summit due to time, injury, or a sudden onset of inclement weather. But you keep going back. Hiker, mountaineer, author Daniel Arnold has transitioned from nonfiction to fiction in his third book, Snowblind. I met up with him in a bookstore where he was scheduled to read and sign this book of short stories. So tell me about Snowblind. It's a collection of stories. Are they based on actual events or personal experiences? Or?
They're not. They're genuine fiction. Many of them started from seeds, and the seeds could be anything from a moment of a climb of my own or something I'd read in a book or just a snippet of something I caught somewhere. But I was always surprised because I'd start sort of picking apart the idea that interested me. And by the time I was done, you know, the seed would be in there somewhere, but it had really no resemblance anymore. The story had become its own adventure. So while there might be a minuscule amount of personal experience in a few of these, it's just a line here or there.
Well, because you've seen and experienced some aspect of it, so sure. It helps. They always say write from personal experience, right?
Sure, yeah. And this book couldn't be written by someone who isn't a climber. There are authors who are really, really good at projecting themselves into things that they don't do. But this is a book that's really, you know, written from the inside of climbing, which is not to say that it's just for climbers. A lot of people said, oh, so your book is just for mountain climbers. But really, I think it's adventure tales that anyone can enjoy, both very hardcore climbers and people who know nothing about climbing.
People who like adrenaline rushes.
Yeah, but I think more than that. I mean, what I think is, it's strange that no one seems to write the kind of old-fashioned adventure tale anymore.
Well, probably because back in the day, say 1800s, turn of the century, they didn't have the internet and movie theaters as much as we do now, and so we had to rely on the written word.
Sure, so you think that sort of that desire for the adventure story was kind of, is being taken away by movies and that kind of media now?
I do, and you don't rely on your imagination as much anymore.
I think that's true, and I think also part of it is that we've had really, really good nonfiction over the last several decades. I mean, you think about all the great mountaineering nonfiction books that have been out there, but there's been no good climbing fiction or even, say, adventure fiction that I know of in the last several decades. And that's sad. I mean, I love those old stories. And I think, I mean, in some ways, in the back of my mind, like, I wrote this book mostly just for the enjoyment of it and hoping that readers would get enjoyment out of it. But if I have any kind of higher aspirations for it, I'd love it if it would reclaim a little bit of that lost ground.
Well, could you read a little bit?
Sure.
From it?
Absolutely.
In which section will you be reading from first?
Why don't I read... This is Coward's Run. It's a story that has kind of all the architecture of the classic adventure tale. Two boys, a boat, a mountain. So here's Coward's Run. Here's what a 17-year-old will do. He'll come into class one day with a leather jacket or a mustache or the key to a 78 Power Wagon on its second engine and act like he's scratching the world's balls. For Skim, it was the day after he acquired his uncle's boat, a 19-foot sloop named Coward's Run. Now, sloop might sound handsome to you. It did to me until I hunted up Simpson's Nautical in the Gustavus Public Library and found out that a hog trough with a single mast through its middle and two sails would qualify. And that's about what it looked like Skim's uncle had given him. But Skim was ready to navigate the high seas. He wanted to smuggle in bales of weed from British Columbia, or invade North Korea and bring justice to the commies. He bragged about the boat's shallow draft and lift-up centerboard. He could land it on a beach in the middle of the night, and no one would be a gnat's fart wiser. Wasn't I 17, too? I listened to him rhapsodize about beach landings while we hunted and pecked through keyboard drills, then interrupted to ask the question which had been burning my mind for at least 10 minutes. Yo, Skim, why don't we sail north, land your cockle shell in Lituya Bay, and climb Mount Fairweather from Tidewater? I watched his wheels spin like a four-wheeler in mud month. Then he got traction, and we talked about nothing else till summer. We grew up four houses apart on the old Strawberry Point at the mouth of Glacier Bay. Skim's dad taught him fishing and sea ballads. My parents gave me geology and Homer. We got on well with each other and our place in the world. 200 years ago, the present-day glaciers were all tributaries, and the bay was the trunk of a honkin' ice river. Strawberry Point was nothing more than the outflow plain of sand and gravel where the big glacier crapped out all the crushed-up mountain it had digested. When the big glacier absconded to join the mastodons and brontosaurs, the ocean filled in, and Strawberry Point became beachfront. South, we had waves and whales and cruise ships, the latter sliding by like alien rockets, with no time for the natives. North was rain, snow, and mountains. Skim and I, we headed north when we could. We'd just walk out of town with our backpacks on, step into the woods, go uphill, till we hit snow and ridgelines and summits. The school and library were sidelong to the airstrip, and in summers, guys with carefully packed North Face duffels would land, hire ski planes, and fly off to Fairweather or Mount Crillon. So we knew that there were bigger mountains around us, the kind that people from other states and countries would travel around the world to climb. But buying time in a ski plane was a luxury beyond us. Money slipped by on the cruise ships, like seeing Los Angeles on TV. Folks in town went out to work the water, catching fish or tourist dollars as they could. But we were a stagnant little eddy outside the global currents. Besides, as I said to Skim one day on a practice run in the icy strait, while we were disentangling the main sheet in a rain squall that was about 1 degree too warm to be a blizzard, a ski plane is a damned inelegant thing. Once you flew a plane to a mountain, what kept you from landing higher? Why not land 100 feet below the summit? But a boat. No boat could float you higher than sea level. All through the spring, a local euphemism for unending gray dampness, Mount Fairweather occupied the northern horizon of our minds. Child of earthquakes, mother of snow, glaciers crawled down its shoulders like dreadlocked snakes on a Medusa. From the summit, you could see deep Pacific waves strike the edge of North America and the black-white wilderness of the Canadian interior, and maybe even your own soul. The first day of summer freedom, we had a little party on the public dock. We'd loaded Coward's Run to the gunwales with beans and rice and our tatty third-hand mountaineering gear. Skim had found a bucket hat and a straight-stemmed mahogany pipe at the church thrift. He was cousin to a stork, pale-faced and gangly, with a blue vinyl storm suit draped on him like a coat on a hat rack. He kept the brim of his new lid a half inch off his nose and worked that unlit pipe around his mouth like a stick of fossilized chewing gum, grinning and muttering the refrain of farewell to Nova Scotia under his breath. Skim's dad, twice as broad as his son, a hairy ape of a crab-pot fisherman, played Hawaiian airs on a slack-key guitar, looking like a spider strangling a fly. My parents sat hand in hand dockside on a plank bench with complicated expressions on their faces that I tried not to interpret too closely for fear of losing my outgoing tide. Eventually, Captain Skim swung up onto the bow and said, "Never fear, we'll keep between the sea and the sky and come home men." Skim's dad popped a loud raspberry through his fingers, and Skim added, "Thanks, Dad. I guess when men go to sea, they come back boys." Then his dad broke a bottle of homebrew against the boat's prow and cut his thumb, which both he and Skim interpreted as a fabulous sign. They raced back and forth along the Coward, pressing bloody thumbprints up and down her hull to give her a proper baptism. While they ritualized on board and our friends stood around drinking from unbroken bottles and discussing the fine points of seagoing superstition, my mom gave me a paperback copy of Captain Cook's expedition journals. The world, my little corner of it anyway, suddenly looked clearer. It dawned on me that my parents had been 17, too. I saw my dad's proud thunderhead beard, my mom's long black hair twitching in the wind with the gray sea and restless Alaskan sky behind her, and I thought, maybe they still are. The book had a $2 bill for a bookmark. The money wouldn't do me any good where I was going, but I understood. $2 bills were what they used to pay sailors when they returned home. I traded places with Skim's dad and undid the dock lines. We lacked a motor, so Skim's dad grabbed our prow and heaved us backward. Our departure was voluntary, but it looked to me like the ocean god tossing Odysseus out to sea. Skim raised the main, and I cleated the starboard jib sheet, and the south wind, A fair, sweet wind we like to call the peach brought us around and filled the sails. We had 2 months of food and could travel as far as the wind and our sail canvas would take us. Sure as I was that I would return, I barely looked back. We bobbed out past the mouth of Glacier Bay over 2 foot waves, light as a cork.
Nice.
Thank you.
Now, what kind of an adventurous life did you have when you were a child? You grew up in Portland, is that right?
Yeah, my mom and I moved up to Portland when I was 7, maybe I was 6.
From where?
From California. We kind of bounced around California for a while. And then we moved up to Portland, and with my stepdad, we spent a lot of time on Mount Hood. So pretty much sort of some of my strongest, earliest memories are hiking Mount Hood, snowshoeing around Mount Hood, going, learning how to ski. So Mount Hood was really both my kind of early playground, but also where I learned a lot of
technical aspects.
Well, technical aspects, but also just how to exist in the wilderness. I mean, I would just go for these long hikes on my own, off trail, because that's what I love to do. And so just sort of learning how to navigate the world, I started doing that as a young kid up on Mount Hood. And I didn't climb the mountain until I was 15, so that was 8 years later, but that was sort of always in the back of my mind as I was spending all that time up on the mountain.
Now, do you have siblings?
I don't. I've got 3 half-siblings, but I didn't grow up with them quite in the same way as most people do with their siblings.
So you were the Lone Ranger insofar as...
Yeah, insofar as the house that I grew up in, yeah.
You didn't have any shared adventures. It was kind of you.
Yeah, pretty much, and I enjoyed that, and I've always enjoyed going alone. Now, I mean, one of the great joys of my life is doing climbs and backpacks and runs with my wife. It's fantastic that I've found an adventure buddy, so to speak. But I really enjoy being out there on my own. It's a deep pleasure for me.
A lot of kids don't have that option.
Yeah.
Or they don't have that awareness. It isn't being introduced to them.
Yeah.
Until maybe at a later date. So
yeah, I think that's right.
I had a similar experience. As a kid, we did a lot of backpacking, but a lot of camping, mm-hmm. and road trips and... And of course, when I got to be a teenager, then I didn't want to have anything to do with my family. I'm never hiking again. But of course,
don't tell that to my son. He has to go hiking with us.
Well, it came full circle because I do it now.
Yeah.
And my dad still laughs about it. So when you went on your first adventure away from home, how old were you?
Ooh, are we talking like first day hike on my own, or are we talking...
No, adventure. Like, it wasn't just your average day hike. It was saying, okay, this sounds kind of scary.
Yeah.
This sounds a little risky.
Yeah.
I'm going to give it a shot.
Oh, I don't know about scary and risky. That, in some ways, that may have come later. But I remember maybe I was 12 years old and exploring some of the pretty distant canyons on Mount Hood on my own, where I just, you know, I'd light off for the day and see how far I could go into these canyons. And I think that's probably about the age when I really started to do those sorts of things.
Expand your horizons, literally.
Yeah.
And figure
out. Exactly.
But as far as I say, to really push yourself, beyond just your basic hiking, when, as you said, off trail.
Yeah.
But of course, as we both know, there are places where off trail.
Off trail means many
a lot
different
more
things.
More than that, yes.
I don't know. I mean, in some ways, maybe it was some of my first trips to Smith Rock. I had 2 really good high school friends, and they and I would load into Dan's Honda Civic, my friend Dan's Honda Civic, and we'd drive off to Smith Rock for spring break. And maybe it was that, but probably it was the winter break of my freshman year in college. I flew down to Mexico to climb El Pico de Orizaba, which is the highest peak in Mexico. And I think it's 19,000 feet or something like that. It was a good experience in the sense that I was so painfully foolish, just in the sense of, you know, I'd never traveled internationally on my own. I hadn't climbed that many mountains at that point. Like, I'd climbed the local mountains in the Oregon area. And, you know, Orizaba is not that, it's not a particularly technical mountain, but it's high and it's way out there. And so I screwed up so many different things. Just the acclimatization schedule, for one thing. I mean, I'd read all the books about acclimatization, but I got on the ground, my plane dropped me off, and I was like, oh, I've got to get to the mountain right now. Because if I don't get to the mountain right now, I don't know what. I mean, it's this weird thing when you're young and you're like, oh, I've got to go do this right away. And the idea of just, you know, taking your time and doing it the correct way somehow just flies out of your mind. And so I think I got to the summit maybe like 48 hours after I landed, and I just felt horrible. I mean, I was so poorly acclimatized, it's kind of a wonder that I dragged myself up to the top at all. But all I could think about was, gotta get there. It's funny how the brain works when you're a teenager.
Now, you've traveled in other countries since then.
Yeah, I'm really a West Coast climber. I've done some travel, but there are lots and lots of people who have done way, way more than I do.
But it's still a nice sampling of the different environments.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly it gave me a lot of material to work with for Snowblind, because all of the climbs in Snowblind are sort of flung around the world in various places. And without some of those early experiences of climbing in Mexico and Peru and Argentina, I wouldn't have had the same kind of material to draw on for those stories. But in my heart, I'm a local climber. The High Sierra is heaven for me.
It's hard to do better than that.
Absolutely. And the Oregon Cascades, too. I mean, I can't get enough of those mountains.
And you live near Emigrant Wilderness?
Near Emigrant, so near Yosemite. Handy. So it's really nice to just have those right...
For exercise and nothing else.
Essentially in the backyard.
And how old are your kids?
I've got a 4-year-old son. His name is Sage.
Of course it is. You've written 2 books before Snowblind. Mm-hmm. So tell me about how those came to be.
Those were nonfiction books. And oddly enough, the first stories in Snowblind were written before I started the nonfiction books. I started out thinking I was going to be a fiction writer. And then these 2 big nonfiction projects just kind of blossomed in my mind, and I kind of had to chase them down before I returned to the short story. So I wrote a couple of the stories before the first book. I wrote a couple of them in between the 2 books, and then finished the second half of Snowblind after the last book. The first book is called Early Days in the Range of Light, and it's the history of the first 70 years of climbing in the Sierra. And for me, this was such a fantastic project because lots has been written about the quote-unquote golden age of Yosemite climbing. But this was a generation that kind of just fell off the map of climbers. So this is from the early 1860s to the early 1930s. And this was before rope belaying techniques, as we know them, came around the world to California. So for that entire 70 years, it was essentially a group of hardcore soloists. They went up into the mountains climbing hard routes with just their fingers in their boots because they didn't know anything else. And then on top of that, there were just, these people really formed interesting, deep relationships with the mountains. They were philosophers and scientists and artists, and so they were all trying to sort of come to understand what it meant to be in these beautiful places. It's people like John Muir and Clarence King who formed those interesting relationships with the places that they traveled.
Of course, now, I shouldn't say of course, but those of us who hike frequently are aware that even the trails are starting to become crossbreeders for cyclists, dirt bikes, and it's kind of a struggle right now on who gets to go where these days. What's your take on that?
Well, and I have no particular problem with mountain bikers. Most mountain bikers that I know are very respectful of both the trails and other people. Obviously, there are some who are not, but there are some hikers who are obnoxious too. My feeling is that I'm very, very happy that there are wilderness areas where no machines are allowed. I think that's just paramount. That needs to stay as it is. For that matter, right now there's a big issue with snowmobiles in winter, because what's the Forest Service supposed to do in terms of regulating where they go? The snowmobiles end up in wilderness areas where they're not supposed to be. And so there's all sorts of issues like that. But in areas that are not wilderness, I'm not necessarily opposed to mountain bikes, so long as they're using the trails wisely. I mean, to be honest, and this is sort of maybe my personal axe to grind, I've had much more trouble with horses than I have with mountain bikes.
Really?
You come across these just enormous animals on a narrow trail, and the animals are skittish, and you never quite know, like, where am I supposed to go? Like, how far do I need to get away from the hooves? All of a sudden, I'm, like, trampling on all these things on the side of the trail to get out of the way. And then you'll come across these, you know, pack strings of 30 tourists on mules in, say, the Emigrant Wilderness, and it takes 10 minutes, probably not 10 minutes, 5 minutes for them to go by. For me, it's actually the horses that are more of an issue. A lot of the Yosemite trails will end up being ankle deep in dried horse manure by the end of the season.
Well, so the plant life is happy about that.
Well, some of it. I guess, I mean, in some ways, I almost wonder if one solution would be to think about sort of more single-use trails. Once you've got a true single track, it's really hard to get around anyone else. So sort of anyone who's moving at a different speed or on a different device.
And as you mentioned earlier, the groups, like as Everest is a prime example. Like, holy crap.
Yeah. You know, it's a funny thing with Mount Everest, and I have come to be very... The amount of attention that Mount Everest gets from both climbers and non-climbers, I find very distressing. Because in the end, it's a mountain and a culture around that mountain that's quite abusive to the mountain itself. And we have this weird fixation on Mount Everest. And just, you know, as a simple example, like Into Thin Air, which is an extremely well-written book, is essentially about a bunch of tourists stuck in a traffic jam on Mount Everest. And it's really sad that that is the one famous American mountaineering book, because there's so many better climbing stories, which is not to say that Into Thin Air isn't well-written. It is. But there's so many really, really good, true climbing stories that have been ignored in the kind of tunnel vision that Americans have had for that book.
I guess as a visual, it just seems like it's a fantasy, you know, almost similar to the Himalaya, you know, that the average person will never go up there. So the fantasy starts kicking
in.
And then we're back to the old stories of the 1800s.
Right. Well, and I think partly it's, too, that there is a lot of dysfunction on that mountain, and the dysfunction is it sells in a certain way.
So back to Snowblind, I belong to a few different meetup hiking groups, and I love that because now they're becoming more accessible and introducing more families and peak hikers. And what I love about it is it introduces even me. I'm a native Californian, and I didn't know some of these trails even existed, let alone the number of lakes that you can't see unless you go on these hikes, and it's fabulous.
Right.
And north to south, this state has such a diverse terrain geography that... Why would you want to go to any other states unless Tetons are supposed to be a kind of
The Tetons are pretty fantastic. I mean, I think that California is... It's one of the unparalleled beauty spots of the world. Galen Rowell, I think he said something along the lines of, I grew up climbing in the High Sierra, and then I went traveling all around the world looking for something sort of to equal the High Sierra or to be better than the High Sierra, and then I just ended up coming home because there wasn't anything. I mean, there are higher mountains... There are fabulously beautiful places elsewhere in the world, but there's really no mountains on Earth like the Sierra. There's nowhere that you have that kind of sheer, strong, beautiful granite that just kind of comes out of the ground like it's some kind of Shangri-La dream. You know, we're lucky. We're really lucky to be here. I mentioned my other book, Salt to Summit. That's also my fascination with the California geography, because the Salt to Summit, I started in Death Valley and went all off-trail and unsupported up to Whitney, and really kind of crafted this route through Death Valley that was far away from any roads or trails or anything that kind of spoke of the presence of humans. And the desert, I mean, it's incredible. It is one of the most incredible places I've ever been. And there's so many surprises and secrets hiding out there in Death Valley. And that's part of our state, too. I mean, it's incredible.
Could you read another excerpt?
So this is a harder-edged story called Dead Till Proven Otherwise. 2 a.m. Anne chokes off the alarm on her watch. Her bones ache, even the sockets of her eyes. She probes her flesh, groping for her moxie. How much does she have left? Yeah, and how much will she need? Half-breaths of wind rattle the fabric of her bivy sack. Ha! One vertical mile of snowy Alaskan beast below the foot-wide sleeping ledge. She's chopped in the ice, and the beast is snoring. Anne unzips the hood of her bivy sack. Stars. Bright goddamn stars and cold. Cold as a wage slave's soul. Perfect. Day 3, and her weather window has held. She'll meet the sun on top of the mountain. She pops 2 caffeine pills and swallows a gel. She puts her earphones in and thumbs up the sound. Tom Payne lunges at her ears like a dog barking nose down in a hole. White noise obliterates the last syllable, turns to nasty, fire-breathing music just when she's sure her eardrums will tear. Anne made this mix expressly for the small hours. The hairs prickle off her arms. Guitars peeling back her skin, that's what she wants. Metal and caffeine, the god's own breakfast. All else is just calories. Inside her bag, Anne wrestles her plastic doubles onto her feet. pain comes back to remind her that men beg for kings to rule them. No, she'll have no kings. Anne unzips her cocoon, clips herself in short to the two ice screws keeping her leashed against gravity. She packs away her sleeping kit. Her headlamp pricks the darkness, barely wounding it. The horns of the mountain above and the mind-trapping drop below are shadows on black shadows. She steps into her crampons, her favorite part of the morning. With spikes on her feet, she can go crusading. The cold already has its teeth in her, and she's no apple-cheeked gal. When single digits slap her in the face, the color dies out of her skin, and Anne knows she must be chalk-white. She grins juicily. She should have brought some props, some plastic fangs and black eyeliner. Give the mountain a scare. Deep night, laser-white stars, the gigantic black void behind and below. Anne imagines climbing into outer space. Drum blasts displace her skull bones. Heat rises through her flesh to meet the cold. The music is her armor against the void. She means someday to write out her will, which will consist of nothing but a playlist for her funeral, and that will make her happy. Anne threads the leg loops of her harness, drinks half her water, and puts her pack on her back. Her insides twitch. She feels vicious. The knife cutting open the future. She doesn't know what she'll find there, but it's bound to be different from the past if she can just make herself sharp enough.
He's good, isn't he? Yes, it's available on Kindle. Do something different. Walk a neighborhood you usually drive through or past.